Russian capital. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/thevoiceofrussia and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/voiceofrussia. In London, we're currently over the DAB Plus. In Washington, D.C., you can catch us at 1390 AM, 103.5 FM HD2. And in New York, we're at 1430 AM. For more frequencies, you can visit our website at thevoiceofrussia.com/the US. Also, you can click on top. It says on air now to listen to us online. Don't touch that dial. We'll be back with more in just a few moments. Stay tuned. The Voice of Russia.
Moscow headquarters. Radio VR, the voice of Russia.
Top of the hour here in the Russian capital. My name is Miguel Francis. You are tuned in to Radio VR. Let's take a look at today's top stories. Double-edged Ukraine. While law enforcers attempt to clear barricades in central Kiev, President Yanukovych has agreed to hold talks with the opposition. Not going down. Thai President Srinivasa says she will not resign while trying to calm down thousands of protesters by promising elections in just 2 months. Dangerously close. South Korea's leader says the recent purges in North Korea are the making of the, quote, line of terror that there ever is becoming so worrying. And the memorial service for Nelson Mandela, the first black South African president, is underway in the city stadium in Johannesburg, where we will be crossing to it live.
Radio VR News.
A clash between protesters and the police began near barricades in central Kyiv, Ukraine, soon after the unknown people set the barricades on fire. Protests have been continuing in Kyiv since November the 21st, due to the government's decision to shelve an association deal with the EU. President Yanukovych is now to meet with three ex-presidents of Ukraine, as well as EU Foreign Affairs and Security Chief Catherine Ashton, to discuss a possible end to the current protests. The protesters want close ties with the EU, not a customs union with Russia, and yesterday protest leaders gave President Yanukovych 48 hours to dismiss the government. Thai Prime Minister Ingluk Shinawatra on Tuesday refused demands by anti-government protesters that she resign before upcoming elections, urging them to abandon their self-styled people's revolution. Bangkok has been shaken by more than a month of mass opposition rallies. Protesters seek ends to the political influence of fugitive former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra. Thaksin is Prime Minister Ingluk's elder brother. And in a sharp drop from the roughly about 40,000 people who attended protests Monday, police said some 7,650 protesters gathered in the capital Tuesday afternoon calling for the elected government to step down. In Oslo, Norway, today, the OPCW World Chemical Watchdog formally received the Nobel Peace Prize it was awarded in October. Earlier in the day, the OPCW had Uzun Ju said the destruction of serious chemical weapons could begin in late January. The serum weapons are to be destroyed aboard the U.S. Navy's cargo ship MV Cape Ray. The OPCW has spent years trying to rid the world of chemical weapons in relative obscurity before being thrust into the global limelight by the Syrian crisis. The United Nations is launching its first aircraft of food and other aid supplies from Iraq to the Kurdistan region of northern Syria this week with permission from both governments, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, said on Tuesday. The air bridge using commercial cargo Ilyushin 76 planes to Saqqa, Syria from Erbil, Iraq, will begin on Thursday, and up to 12 flights are scheduled through Sunday. Amin Awad, director of the Middle East and North Africa Bureau of the UNHCR, said. A Dutch couple held hostage in Yemen since June this year were released in good health, the Yemeni and Dutch government said on Tuesday. Judith Spiegel, who had been working in Yemen as a researcher, and her partner, Rudolf Berenson, disappeared after they left their home in Sanaa in June. No one has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping. A joint statement by the two governments read out on state television said the couple had been received by the Dutch ambassador. They are due to fly to the Netherlands on Wednesday. US President Barack Obama on Tuesday eulogized Nelson Mandela as a giant of history who earned his place in prosperity through struggle, shrewdness, and by showing the power of political action. Obama is one of many world leaders attending the memorial service honoring the late South African anti-apartheid leader at a Soweto football stadium in Johannesburg. Nelson Mandela spent a total of 27 years in jail in 1993. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize and he ruled South Africa as president from May 1994 till June 1999. Radio VR News, over to you, Miguel. Thanks so much, Pavel. Let's now take a look at the weather in some of the cities that we are currently broadcasting to here in Radio VR, starting with London, currently at 48 Fahrenheit, partly cloudy for the hour, and some fog starting later tonight, continuing until tomorrow morning. On to the Americas now, kicking things off with New York, 37 Fahrenheit, light rain for the hour, and some heavy snow coming in until this afternoon. Washington, D.C. currently has a winter storm warning for the District of Columbia, so heavy snow for the hour, 34 Fahrenheit, and heavy rain continuing throughout the day. And the hottest place to listen to Radio VR, as usual, is Miami, Florida. 77 Fahrenheit, partly cloudy for the hour, and partly cloudy later throughout this morning. You're tuned in to the Voice of Russia. My name is Miguel Francis, and we would like to remind our listeners that the views of our guests are their personal views and are not necessarily shared by the editorial staff of Radio VR. We will continue in a moment.
Radio VR. This is the Voice of Russia.
Thai Prime Minister Windhoek Shinawatra has refused to resign amid the ongoing political turmoil fueled by large-scale protests in the Asian nation. Demonstrators have been calling for Shinawatra to step down and be replaced with, quote, a people's prime minister. Speaking to reporters on Tuesday, Windhoek urged the protesters to, quote, use the electoral system to choose who will become the next government. Thailand will hold new elections on February the 2nd.
Prime Minister Windhoek Shinawatra dissolved the nation's parliament on Monday in a move aimed at easing tensions between demonstrators and the government. However, protest leader Suthep Thaugsuban has rejected dialogue and vowed to topple Windhoek. Around 150,000 protesters rallied in Bangkok on Monday, attempting to storm Shinawatra's office known as Government House. Suthep Thaugsuban said the protesters want to select a people's prime minister and set up a government of the people and the people's assembly to replace parliament. As the snap elections have been scheduled for February the 2nd, Windhoek may not be her party's choice to run. The ruling party spokesman said he does not know whether the pro-Thai party will still vote for her to run again or not. The Pale Thai Party has a majority in parliament and draws significant support from Thailand's rural areas. The party is seen as well placed to win February's election.
Now, anti-government protesters say that few Thai parties controlled by ousted leader Thaksin Shinawatra, his brother, they accuse it of using public funds irresponsibly to secure votes and want the government to be replaced with an unelected People's Council. Thaksin Shinawatra is in self-imposed exile after he was overthrown in a military army coup in 2006 and convicted of corruption. Evgeny Belenki, Bangkok bureau chief of RIA Novosti, says it is unlikely that Thai Prime Minister Windhoek Shinawatra will resign before the elections. He also adds the demands of the protesters do not fall under the country's constitution.
She has already said firmly that she's not going to resign until the new cabinet is elected through due process of law and constitution. So she is not yielding to the demands of the demonstrators. and the whole system of new system of government proposed by the demonstration, it is out of constitutional system. So it basically is up to current cabinet if they address the keys and ask for resignation. That's the only way they can resign, and they're not going to do that. The demands of the protesters are very much out of the realm of constitutional rule. Of course, there is there are very diversified opinions on what's actually happening at the protest. What they call for is not people's prime minister, but a royally appointed prime minister. And that can be done by the constitution in case the government addresses the king and says that it cannot rule at the moment.
And that was Evgeny Belenki, Bank of Borough Chief over in Novosti. The United States has joined the French military operation in the Central African Republic. In the coming days, the American Air Force will start transporting African Union peacekeepers into the violent-hit regions. The move follows a request from France that is currently trying to restore order in the CAR. Meanwhile, the French presidency has just reported two French soldiers were killed during Monday's disarmament operation in the capital, Bangui.
In a telephone call with his American counterpart, French Minister of Defense Yves Le Drian asked the United States for limited military assistance in an effort to ease tensions in the African country. In response to the request, Chuck Hagel issued an order to begin transporting forces from Burundi to the Central African Republic in coordination with France. The air raid is expected to take place within the next 24 hours, with 850 Burundian peacekeepers transported to Sahara in American planes. Meanwhile, U.S. President Barack Obama, addressing the citizens of the African country, urged them to stay calm amid rising sectarian violence. Mr. Obama said he begged Muslim and Christian leaders in calling for peace in the region and the arrest of those behind the bloodshed. French officials announced earlier that the amount of the African Union peacekeepers would be increased from 2,500 to 6,000. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon had as many as 9,000 peacekeepers would be required. Last week, France started a military intervention in the region following the unanimous approval by the UN Security Council. As of Monday, 1,600 French troops are reportedly on the ground.
The military intervention in the Central African Republic was announced after a surge of violence that claimed the lives of at least 300 people in the capital Bangui last week. This Monday, French soldiers started disarming fighters, and by night, most of the militiamen have been reportedly cleared. Joining me on the phone from Bangui is a senior crisis response advisor at the United Kingdom-based Amnesty International, Joanne Mariner. Joanne, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Not too bad. Great having you. So how critical is the current situation in the CAR?
The situation here is still desperate. Two key problems. One, there is still a very high level of violence. What we're seeing now, which is something of a shift, is continuing attacks on the Muslim population because the anti-Muslim, what are known as anti-Balaka forces, are seeing the Muslims' vulnerability now that the government forces are being disarmed by the French. So we've seen a lot of opportunistic killings of Muslim civilians. We also still have a desperate situation of tens of thousands, and one estimate is up to 100,000 displaced people in Bangui, primarily Christians who fear returning to their homes. And these people are now living out, you know, in the air, without any protection, with very little medical care, and with shortages of food. So in recent days, we visited several of these displaced persons' camps, and we've just found extremely difficult conditions there.
Wow. Now, French forces have begun a military operation in the Central African Republic. Will they be able to curb the increasing sectarian violence in the country, do you think?
That is a good question. Obviously, the French are taking aggressive steps to try to protect the civilian population and to stop the violence. Yesterday, they started disarming the SOMATA, which are the sort of de facto government forces, which are the forces that are responsible for much of the violence. So we're trying to take the weapons away from these people. But what we're seeing at this point is really intense communal hatred, sectarian hatred. So, for example, this morning we witnessed a mosque being burnt to the ground and torn down by an angry Christian mob. And the members of that mob were yelling anti-Muslim slogans, saying that all the Muslims should leave the country. And on the Muslim side, too, you hear some of the same anger. So really the question is, when you have this kind of community, you know, societal level hatred, will the French be able to restore order? I think it's clearly going to be very difficult.
Wow. When will the human species understand that we're just human beings, a living experience on this planet? That's a big question. But what is at the heart of the conflict in the African nation? Is it really just simply sectarian religious violence and hatred? Or is there more to this?
I think there's much more to it. And in fact, it certainly initially was not a sectarian conflict. It was much more an opportunistic grab at power by a group of, rebel groups that was assisted by mercenaries from other countries. So in March of this year, when there was a coup, it was carried out by a rebel group that was largely a Muslim group, aided by a lot of Chadians and Sudanese. And at that point, it seemed that the interest really was primarily economic. They took advantage of taking power to push Google systematically to, steal from the civilian population, to take control of the country's natural resources. So the Central African Republic is a large producer of diamonds. It has a lot of diamond mines. We saw some of these warlords taking control of the diamond mines. It has timber that's quite valuable. It has quite a lot of livestock. Initially, I think this really was driven by, one, just the desire to take power, but two, to have everything that comes with that power, i.e., economic. The majority country has stirred this sectarian hatred, and it's developed over time, but it's really come to a head, especially of course in the last week when we had this spate of violence that started on Thursday. And right now the official count of the dead is at about 459, but we have documented that in fact quite a lot of people are not buried without being part of that official count. So it's very possible that there were at least 1,000 dead killed in 2 days of violence as violence continues. So, as I said, it's a really, really difficult situation here right now.
Let's just hope that the resolution can come with the participation and mediation of the international community as we see the situation evolve. Thank you so much, Joanne. That was Joanne Mariner, a United Kingdom-based Amnesty International Senior Crisis Response Advisor. Protests have been continued in Kyiv since November 21st, since the government decided to hang up Ukraine's association with the EU. On Sunday, three main opposition parties unveiled the preconditions under which they would agree to hold talks with the authorities. Their demands include the resignation of the government led by Nikolai Azarov and the release of protesters who were detained during the rallies. They also demanded punishment for the representatives of law enforcement agencies who used violence to disperse protests. On Sunday, demonstrators strengthened their position in the government quarters by building barricades in many places. This blocked the traffic in central Kyiv. On Monday, law enforcement decided to press protesters back on the roads and dismantle the barricades.
An ongoing armed conflict in
year has taken the lives of more than 100,000 people, forcing over 2 million Syrians to flee the country. As the civil war in the region approaches its 3-year milestone, Radio VR counts the losses. Tune into our daily project, Syrian Crisis, Victims of the Carnage. The conflict in Syria has had a catastrophic effect on children. According to a report recently published by the Oxford Research Group, 11,420 underage boys and girls, many of them tortured and executed, have been killed since March 2011. And that's only the deaths of named victims. Most of them died in explosions, shell fire, or by aerial bombardment. But what's even more horrifying is that over 1,000 children were executed or killed by snipers. Some of them were even tortured before being killed, says Hamid Dardagan, co-director of the Every Casualty Program at the Oxford Research Group, and this is what he said.
7 out of 10 children have been killed by explosive weapons of different kinds, whether aerial bombardment, shelling, artillery fire, and so on. These indiscriminate weapons, of course, if used in populated areas, tend to kill civilians, including children. But 4 of the deaths were from small arms fire, and within that, there's clear evidence that the kinds of weapons being used are deliberately targeting children. So, for example, the nearly 400 children who were killed by sniper fire, and nearly 800 who were killed by summary executions.
Syrian refugee children, and there are over 1 million of them, are also paying a cruel price in the ongoing civil war. School-aged children living as refugees outside Syria are cut off from education and forced to work long hours for low pay. Many are growing up in fractured families and are often the household's main breadwinners. That's according to a report released by the United Nations Refugee Agency. As many as 300,000 living in Lebanon and Jordan could be without schooling by the end of 2013. Many of those not at school go out to work, some as young as 7 years old, facing grave dangers even outside the war zone. Thus, kids who live in the refugee camps often don't receive the necessary health care, says Dr. Bart Jensens, the director of operations for Doctors Without Borders in Brussels.
There are many, many areas where good medical and psychological support for children is probably fully unavailable. As an example, in the north, MSF has 6 hospitals and 2 health centers where we provide basic health care for about 250,000 people. In this respect, we take a lot of effort to get health care for children and vaccinations. But in many other areas, such activities we know of are not available.
More than 70,000 Syrian refugee families now live without fathers, with some 3,700 refugee children living unaccompanied or without both parents. With these figures rising day by day, it is now clear that nothing but peace can save the lives of little Syrians and bring the hope for a happy future to the youngest victims of the carnage.
VR News. Clash between protesters and the police began near barricades in central Kyiv, Ukraine, soon after this unknown people set the barricades on fire. Protests have been continuing in Kyiv since November the 21st due to the government's decision to shelve an association deal with the EU. President Yanukovych is now to meet with 3 ex-presidents of Ukraine as well as EU Foreign Affairs and Security Chief Catherine Ashton to discuss a possible end to the current protests. Now, the protesters want close ties with the EU, not a customs union with Russia. Yesterday, protest leaders gave President Yanukovych 48 hours to dismiss the government. Thai Prime Minister Ingvar Shinawatra on Tuesday refused demands by anti-government protesters that she resign before upcoming elections, urging them to abandon their self-styled People's Revolution. Bangkok, the capital of Thailand, has been shaken by more than a month of mass opposition rallies. Just a sick end to the political influence of fugitive former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra. Thaksin is Prime Minister Ingvar's elder brother. In a sharp drop from the roughly 140,000 people who attended protests Monday, they said some 7,650 protesters gathered in the capital Tuesday afternoon, calling for the elected government to step down. And in Oslo today, the OPCW World Chemical Watchdog formally received the Nobel Peace Prize it was awarded in October. Earlier in the day, the OPCW had risen to said the destruction of serious chemical weapons could begin in late January 2014. The Syrian weapons are to be destroyed aboard the U.S. Navy's cargo ship MV Cape Ray.
OPCW spent years trying to rid the world of chemical weapons in relative obscurity before being thrust into the global limelight by the Syrian crisis. Roll over the news. Over to you, Miguel.
Breaking news.
And some fresh breaking news just came in here to Radio VR. The former Ukrainian president, Leonid Kravchuk, has announced that Kyiv could sign an association agreement with the EU next spring if a compromise is reached, of course. The announcement came after Kravchuk's meeting with Ukraine's current president, Viktor Yanukovych. And earlier, Kravchuk said a Ukrainian delegation will head for Brussels in the near future for talks with the EU. And now let's take a look at the business with Nikita Alentyev.
The U.S. government has sold its remaining shares in General Motors, leaving it with a loss of around $10 billion on the bailout of the carmaker. The U.S. Treasury spent $49.5 billion bailing out GM in 2008 and 2009 and took a 61% stake in the carmaker. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew said the move prevented the collapse of the U.S. auto industry and saved a million jobs. GM filed for bankruptcy protection in June 2009, making it the biggest failure of an industrial company in U.S. history. The reorganization saw it slash 13 car plants and 27,000 employees in the United States. Over to Europe, the French economy will grow by 0.5% in the final 3 months of the year, said the country's central bank. Rising industrial production prompted the Bank of France to raise its quarterly growth forecast from 0.4%. The country's official NC statistics agency is currently predicting 0.4% growth in the final quarter. The upgrade comes after the bank's business sentiment survey rose to a two-year high in France, which emerged from recession at the start of 2013. France's industrial sector index was found to be up to 101 points in the survey. This marks the first time it rose to above 100, its long-term average, since May 2011. And finally, China's exports rose more than expected in November, adding to signs of a rebound in the world's second-largest economy. Shipments rose 12.7% from a year ago, up from a 5.6% rise in October. Most analysts had forecast a growth of 7%. Last week, data showed manufacturing activity in China grew at its fastest pace in 18 months in November. The jump in exports was triggered by strong demand from importing markets such as the United States and European Union. Over the past few months, Beijing has announced stimulus measures aimed at helping exporters and boosting domestic demand. These include tax breaks for small businesses and reduced fees for exporters, which some analysts said has also started to have an impact on the trade numbers. Meanwhile, data released on Sunday showed that imports rose 5.3% during the month from a year earlier. While that was weaker than forecast, analysts said it was not a cause for concern.
Breaking news.
And more breaking news just poured in here to Radio VR. A Ukrainian delegation is likely to be in Brussels already tomorrow for talks with the European Union. That is according to Ukraine's President Viktor Yanukovych. Earlier, it was reported that former Ukrainian President Leonid Kravchuk announced after a meeting with Yanukovych that Kyiv had signed an association agreement with the EU next spring if a compromise is reached. You are tuned in to The Voice of Russia. My name is Miguel Francis, and we will continue in a moment.
Radio VR.
Let's now take a look at some of the latest developments happening around the planet. This is the World Update. The Russian parliament has accused Western nations of interfering in Ukraine and said protesters demonstrating against Kyiv's policies are destabilizing the country. Russia is urging the West to stop putting pressure on the politics of its brotherly country. French Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian has announced that the number of French troops deployed to the Central African Republic is enough to stabilize the situation in the region. There are currently about 1,500 French troops in the region, alongside the African troops who were earlier deployed to try to stop the violence. Six people have been reported dead as looting continues in Argentina. Hundreds were also injured. Police have refused to go on patrol until their demands for a salary raise are met. And that is according to the BBC.
One rebel fighter has been killed in Sudan's Blue Nile state during clashes with military convoys. Several government troops were also reported dead and three other rebels injured. There was no immediate comment from Sudan's army spokesman. That is according to AFP. Chinese hackers spied on five European foreign ministers before the G20 summit in St. Petersburg. That is according to a report by a U.S. computer security firm, FireEye. The company's researchers did not specify the nations whose ministers had been hacked, but it said the theme of the attack was a serious issue. FireEye experts say the hackers sent emails to the ministry's officials. When recipients opened them, the malware was automatically loaded into their computers. FireEye was able to monitor the hackers' activities for about a week in late August. In September, shortly before the G20 summit in St. Petersburg, the company lost access to the hackers' server. The researchers believe the hackers were preparing to start stealing data on the Syrian conflict. One of the company's researchers said that judging from the technical data, the hackers were from China. But he added that technical data was not enough to confirm it 100%. FireEye said it has been following the hackers behind the Syria-related attack for several years, but this is the first time the group's activities have been publicly documented. Western cybersecurity firms monitored tens of hacking groups operating in China. They believe that most of these groups are tied to the Chinese government. China has long denied the allegation, claiming instead that it is a victim of U.S. spying. North Korea is undertaking a large-scale purge amounting to a reign of terror. That's the latest coming from South Korea's President Park Geun-hye, who said on Tuesday this could further strain relations between the two countries.
South Korean president held a cabinet meeting, part of which was broadcast on television, that Pyongyang was engaged in a purge aimed at strengthening the power of Kim Jong-un. She pointed out that relations between the two Koreas may become more unstable because of this uncalled for vigilance to safeguard the achievements of the West itself. She told the meeting it was important, quote, to keep people safe and free democracy strong. State media reported on Monday that Chol Soon-Jak, the once powerful uncle of the North Korean leader, had been dismissed as a post from a string of criminal acts ranging from mismanagement and corruption to drug taking. His removal is widely seen as the biggest upheaval in the country's leadership since Kim Jong-un succeeded his father.
Now, earlier, a member of South Korea's parliament said Kim Jong-un had embarked on a lengthy purge of potential rivals. BNP told reporters that about 40 people have been executed this year by the Pyongyang regime as a part of its purge campaign. Earlier, Radio VR spoke with Leonid Setrov, a lecturer in Korean Studies College of Asia and the Pacific from Canberra. Commenting on the reported terror campaign in North Korea, Mr. Petrov said that it is not actually something new, as similar methods were used by the country's previous leaders.
North Korea, or Democratic People's Republic of Korea, exists for the last 65 years. And, since then, particularly after the Korean War, which revealed many deficiencies in the regime of Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-un's grandfather, actually prompted the top leader to apply periodic and rather regular purges towards his subordinates, simply to keep the single-handed power regime. And, looks like the young leader, Kim Marshal Kim Jong-un, is simply doing what his father and grandfather did.
Now, Leonid Petrov goes on to say that by dismissing his uncle, the North Korean leader wanted to convey a strong message to the country's elite.
He is the successor of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. He is going to rule the country single-handedly. He is not going to tolerate any interference. He is the boss and he is in the driving seat. That's the domestic message. And internationally also wants to show the national or career watchers and politicians in Seoul and Tokyo and Washington D.C. that he is not going to stop. And the nuclear program which Kim Jong-un started this product is going to be continued by his son, Kim Jong-un. And it's not negotiable, but he is open for negotiations about diplomatic recognition of North Korea, about lifting of sanctions and trade. So I think that he is trying to tell the world that Kim Jong-un is in North Korea for a long time. If you want to deal with North Korea, so you have to deal with Kim Jong-un himself, not with his uncle or aunt or anyone else. The power is strictly in the hands of the young leader, whether it is about economy, politics, or diplomacy.
And that was Luna Petrov, a lecturer in Korean Studies College of Asia and the Pacific from Canberra, commenting on the latest purge campaign in North Korea. Over 124 million people in the EU, or almost a quarter of its entire population, live under the threat of poverty or social exclusion. That is according to a report released by the EU Statistical Office. This data includes people who were either severely materially deprived or those with low work intensity.
The highest number of people living on the verge of poverty, 49%, was recorded in Bulgaria, which is followed by Romania, Latvia, and Greece. On the other hand, the Netherlands and the Czech Republic boast the lowest number of people who are now at risk of poverty, 15%. Even some of the older EU members, like Italy, register a growing poverty rate. With the Italian economy going through its longest recession since the Second World War, over 12% of adults in this country are unemployed, while 4 out of 10 young people don't have a job. Almost 20% of Italians are facing poverty. This is the highest number in the European Union. A volunteer at Caritas Food Emporium in Rome, a place where people can get food for free, has been quoted as saying that they have about 65% of ethnic Italians and 35% of foreigners coming there. 3 years ago, they were about 55% of foreigners and 45% of Italians. So the figures are reversing.
Charity organizations are sounding the alarm, saying that around one-third of all Italian children are now at risk of poverty and are lacking such basic essentials as protein-rich foods, heating, and clothing.
There is no doubt trade among nations makes the world a lot better off. But global trade doesn't stand. It's been playing another vital role from the time Adam Smith set the basis of free trade. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be taking a look into Russia's top 20 biggest trading partners across the world. By adding trade statistics between Russia and Vietnam, look rather modest. Russia is well behind Vietnam's biggest trade partners, like China or the U.S. At the moment, Russia is also the largest investor in Vietnam, with 92 investment projects worth almost $2 billion developing in the country.
In 2012, bilateral trade between Russia and Vietnam increased by 20% to reach $3.6 billion. Vietnam's trade with China stood at $13 billion in the same period of time. According to official projections, trade volume between Russia and Vietnam is on track to top $7 billion in 2015 and $10 billion in the year 2020.
During President Putin's latest visit to Vietnam in November this year, Russian and Vietnamese partners signed many agreements in tandem, covering a rather wide range of sectors. Those included a series of joint ventures and major projects in hydrocarbon energy, construction of the first nuclear power plant in India-China, educational and innovative initiatives, as well as healthcare and a new agreement on military cooperation. A free trade agreement has been negotiated between Vietnam and the countries of the Second Union, Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan.
A free trade zone means for Vietnam cancellation of customs duties and quality caps on the turnover of goods and services. The country is expected to join the free trade zones in the year 2014. Further integration will proceed along three main tracks: peaceful nuclear energy, oil and gas production, and military technical cooperation.
In April 2012, Russian gas giant Gazprom signed a production sharing agreement with Vietnam's state company PetroVietnam, taking 49% in an offshore gas project in South China Sea. Offshore oil production on the Vietnamese continental shelf is being carried out by Yellowbird Neft, which emerged on the basis of joint Soviet and Vietnamese projects.
Russia's business climate has proved quite friendly for Vietnam-based businesses. There have been examples of Vietnamese who were educated in Russia and raised considerable fortunes here before making it big at home. One famous case is billionaire property developer Pham Nhat Vuong, the first person in Vietnam to enter the fourth list of the world's richest people. His fortune is estimated at $1.5 billion.
News.
Former Ukrainian President Leonid Kravchuk has announced that Kyiv could sign an association agreement with the EU next spring if a compromise is reached. The announcement came after Kravchuk's meeting with Ukraine's current president, Viktor Yanukovych. Now, President Yanukovych says the Ukrainian delegation is likely to be in Brussels already tomorrow for talks with the EU. Protests have been continuing in Kyiv since November the 21st due to the government's decision to shelve an association deal with the EU. The protesters were close ties with the EU, not a customs union, but Russia, they say. Yesterday, protest leaders gave President Yanukovych 48 hours to dismiss the government. Thai Prime Minister Ingrid Shinawatra on Tuesday refused demands by anti-government protesters that children dying before upcoming elections, urging them to abandon their self-styled People's Revolution. Bangkok, the capital of Thailand, has been shaken by more than a month of opposition rallies. To the political influence of fugitive former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra. Thaksin is Prime Minister Yudhoyono's father. In a sharp drop from the roughly 140,000 people who attended the protest Monday, police said some 7,650 protesters gathered in the capital Tuesday afternoon, calling for the elected government to step down. U.S. President Barack Obama on Tuesday eulogized Nelson Mandela as the giant of history and his place in prosperity through struggle, goodness, and by showing the power of political action. Obama is one of many world leaders attending the memorial service honoring the late South African anti-apartheid leader at a Soweto football stadium in Johannesburg. Nelson Mandela spent a total of 27 years in jail. In 1993, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize and he ruled South Africa as president from May 1994 to June 1999. In Oslo today, the OPCW World Chemical Watchdog finally received the Nobel Peace Prize. It was awarded in October. Earlier in the day, the OPCW had presumption said the destruction of serious chemical weapons could begin in late January. The serious weapons are to be destroyed at the U.S. Navy's cargo ship MVK Ray. The OPCW has spent years trying to rid the world of chemical weapons in relative territory, before being thrust into the incredible limelight by the human crisis. And the United Nations is launching its first air list of food and other aid supplies from Iraq to the Kurdistan region of northern Syria this week with permission from both governments, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, said on Tuesday. You've been listening to Radio VR News. Now it's back to Miguel.
Thanks so much, Pavel. Let's now take a look at sports with Bastian Kinsikov. Starting with motorsports. Formula One is to award double points at the final race of the season from 2014 in an attempt to heighten interest in the World Championship. The plan is one of a number of changes next season. And F1 teams rejected the proposal to force drivers to make at least 50 stops in each Grand Prix. The idea was put forward as a way of preventing a repeat of 2013 tire problems amid uncertainty about car performance following rule changes. But the proposal received no support from the team. Moving on to football. In England, Hull began his win. Early goal ended his 30-game drought as he scored against his former club Swansea, and both sides earned a battle point in Wales. The Tigers kept their hopes at bay with ease until the hour mark, when Giorgio Chiellini's driven ball from a short corner hit Chico Flores and flew in to give the Spaniard his first Premier League goal. Meanwhile, Celtic suspended 128 fans from their matches and relocated 257 ticket holders following damage caused to Motherwell's turf park on Friday. Streets in the south stand were damaged while smoke bombs and flares were also thrown during Celtic's 5-0 win. Ice hockey now. In the NHL, the Pittsburgh Penguins edged the Columbus Blue Jackets 2-1. Russia's former Evgeny Malkin broke his goal with time in the second period, and captain Sidney Crosby scored what proved to be the deciding goal. Elsewhere, Jason Tatar scored the winning goal in the shootout to lead the Ottawa Senators over the Philadelphia Flyers in a 5-4 thriller. And finally, British Culture Secretary Maria Miller called the meeting with leaders from football, cricket, horse racing, rugby league, and rugby union. The meeting was formed by claims of so-called sports fishing in games. 6 people, including Blackburn Rovers player DJ Campbell, were arrested on Sunday on fishing allegations. It is hoped that sports will be able to share best practice from preventing fishing. And that's all with sports. Bye for now.
Welcome to this week's edition of Echo Plus program. My name is John Harrison. The Centre for International Climate and Environmental Research in Oslo, or CICERO, in short, has earned a reputation for reliable and timely reports on the state of the environment. CICERO has just issued its annual global carbon budget report, in which the world's ongoing emissions of CO2 are written in a clear and comprehensible manner. Among the strongest points in this year's report is that CO2 emissions actually increased by 2.1% in 2012, and a further increase of 2.1% is projected for this year, 2013. The emissions were, according to the report, the highest in human history, only 58% higher than in 1990. For the first international government meeting with Kyoto, Kyoto, an agreement was signed to limit carbon emissions. The new report tells me that in 2012 emissions were dominated by China, which is responsible for 27%, the USA, 14%, and the UK. Chinese emissions were up 5.9%, American emissions were down 3.7%, as of those created by the EU by 1.3%. Now, what does all this mean? Joining me on this program to sort this all out is Glenn Peters, Senior Research Fellow at CICERO in Oslo, and Yuri Rudel from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. And both of you were the lead contributors to this new CICERO report, is that right?
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for the program. It was mainly for the work done by CICERO for the Global Carbon Project.
Yeah.
Although Yuri's involved in similar work.
So I'm involved in similar work, but I'm mainly, I would say, important user of their work.
Well, thank you very much for doing the program. Now, let's start off with the basics. Why is it that the world is still increasing its carbon emissions? I mean, it's 2.1% up. It's a huge amount, isn't it, in previous years?
Yeah, for sure, a continued showing growth in emissions. Mm-hmm. And if you look at where that growth is occurring, in a sense, with the world into the developing countries.
Yeah.
The developed countries, most of them now have some sort of policy and they're stabilizing their emissions. Some countries have declines in their emissions. So most of the growth is occurring in developing countries. Those countries that still want to expand their economies, trying to alleviate poverty and so on. And this is where most of the growth is occurring, actually all of the growth. And in particular, Chinese emissions continue to grow strongly from a very high level, and they're one of the key drivers for emission increases at the global level.
I would like to establish whether or not the amount of emissions that we're experiencing now globally does not fit in with the curves of projections. I mean, they must have made some sort of projections in those days for an increase, but how much did they allow for?
Well, that's a good and perhaps difficult question. There's no quantitative numbers that I'm aware of, but they did the Kyoto Protocol and the Framework Convention talk about stabilizing and controlling emissions in developed countries, but they expected emissions to increase in developing countries as they would drive economic growth. So they didn't put a number on that. But I don't think that the growth to be this large and sort of decade average emissions have increased from 1% per year in the 90s to around about 3% per year in the 2000s. So there's been a speed up since essentially the emergence of China.
Okay, so that's possibly the thing that nobody would have counted for in the original agreement. Okay, how reliable are the figures that are cited in the CICERO report?
They're quite robust. There's some independent organisations producing these numbers as well. And we get quite similar advance rates. If you look at the aggregate levels, we put uncertainty at around about plus or minus 5% at the global level. As you go into the country level, an advanced economy with advanced statistical systems, we generally have lower uncertainty, 3%, while developing countries still kind of increasing its confidence in collecting statistics and estimating emissions value plus or minus 10%.
Well, that's a lot, though, isn't it? I mean, plus or minus 10% is just me. It seems quite difficult to really say that's an accurate figure, plus or minus 10%.
I guess accurate enough, sure. It depends on your purpose, of course. So if there are sort of purposes accurate enough to show the trends and talents, but plus or minus 10% on Chinese emissions, because that's no good, is a country in itself that unfortunately those emissions. But if you wanted to have, for example, like a country like China involved in an international emissions trading system or something like that, and their emission reduction was smaller than the uncertainty in their emissions, then you'll get into potential problems like in the early days of the European trading system when uncertainty was bigger than the reduction.
So just let me clarify that. So if this report states that China is one for 27%, plus or minus 10%, does that mean plus or minus 2.7%?
Around about 3.7%.
Okay, Yuri, now, what about this incredible increase in coal dependency that we're seeing coming out in the report? Although I read that the production in Poland is at last beginning to come down, but particularly in China and actually some of the European countries, we're seeing a huge rise in coal dependency. What's going on?
Indeed, in particular in China, one has seen an incredible rise in coal use in the last couple of years, and also the report that then recently published also showed that really clearly, and this is actually a very important and serious setback when you look at climate protection, and it actually effectively locks in higher carbon emissions for the coming decade.
Yeah.
Because coal is actually the most carbon-intensive fossil fuel. That means that, for example, for one unit of energy, it will produce 70% more carbon than natural gas. And on top of that, kind of, if you build a coal-fired power plant now, it's kind of projected, or they are built with the idea that they are operational for 30 or 50 years. So that means that every coal-fired power plant that is constructed today will only actually stop emitting this very carbon-intensive energy by the middle of the century. So this is an important aspect of locking into high emissions for the next couple of decades, actually.
Yeah, I mean, people who invest in these coal-fired plants aren't really going to want to see their investments close down in 5 years' time, are they? Let's talk more about coal when we come back from a short break. Welcome back to Echo Plus Program on Gas and Russia. Today we're talking about a new report on worldwide carbon emissions produced by the Center for International Climate and Environmental Research, or CICERO, for short, based in Oslo. Joining me is Roy Watson, report from NPC, senior research fellow at CICERO in Oslo, and also I'm joined by Yuri Rogel from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. Now, we just started to talk about coal. I mean, is coal a kind of backdoor carbon fuel that we don't really talk about so much because it's not oil and gas? I mean, for the average man living on the street, perhaps they don't think that coal's really a heavy polluter. But they know all about oil and gas. So we're told about that every day in the newspaper, because how bad that is for the environment. But somehow we don't kind of connect coal with being a major CO2 producer, but you just said before the break that it is. And furthermore, these conversations are going to be really for 30 years or so. Is it about time we sort of started a propaganda campaign or something? A public enlightenment campaign to reveal the actual real horrors of coal?
Well, I think coal is currently responsible for about 40% of global carbon emissions, followed by oil and gas, with each 30 and 20% respectively, about those numbers.
Yeah.
And actually also coal-fired power is also often related to heavy air pollution. And I think it is really in the interest of the public to be aware of the implications of this technology.
Yeah.
And if you, for example, look at China, there in the very recent years, one has been able to observe a switch to gas from coal, not for climate reasons, but for air pollution reasons, because the gas has less air pollutants than coal.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but it seems to be that
many governments are nevertheless going back to coal,
which is kind of, it seems to be a step back, isn't it?
Because people associate coal with being less of a polluter.
That's obviously a basic lack of knowledge, isn't it?
And also, I suppose it's cheaper. It's cheaper to exploit veins of coal than it is to build even necessary technology involved in creating alternative fuel supplies.
Well, the fact that coal would be cleaner, that's indeed not really supported by scientific evidence.
Mm-hmm.
However, it is true that at this point, emitting carbon is not passed, but there are no effective global regulations on that. So indeed, the fact that a certain fuel would emit more or less carbon than another one is not taken into account at all by energy companies. It just doesn't show up in their bills. So an energy company will try to deliver the energy it is asked to deliver at the most beneficial price.
And the end user doesn't really care, does he or she? I mean, when I get my energy bill, I'm not going to question whether the energy came from alternative fuel supply or coal or oil and gas. I'm just happy to get electricity and not pay too much for it.
Well, in Europe, you already see a shift of users actually choosing to have options where the energy they're paid for actually comes from renewable sources. However, this is only a small part of the actual entire user base, also in Europe.
We're all kind of sitting here thinking, you know, it's all going to be all right, isn't it? It's not going to be all right. If we keep on increasing our carbon emissions by 2.1%, we're going to hit that magic year 2020 soon, and we're going to go over that 2% with a 2-degree rise, and then the hell's going to break loose. Now, one of the big boys involved, of course, is China. How can we stop China doing what China does? Is there any sort of international environmental lobby we can create or something? Is there a way that we can stop this?
Well, China is good for many reasons. It's a large country. It has a lot of domestic coal resources, and they naturally use those resources to produce energy.
Yeah.
We often look at the sort of the positive developments in China. They are investing a lot of money in renewables, for example. I think in 2012, the growth in renewable energy production in China was about 25%. But this growth is in a very low level, and in comparison to coal, which is that growth.
If I may interrupt you, I would like to say that at the same time that China is being invested billions of dollars in windmills and solar and solar panels, it's also been opening a new coal-fired power station every week. So, you see what I mean? And of course, in the media, you get these wonderful news about, you know, it's clever, positive news about China being the world leader and everything, investing more money than anybody else. But we don't read the fine print sometimes, you see?
Yeah, so the growth in renewables is nowhere near sufficient to have an effect or offset the growth in coal. And as you say, there's still very strong growth in coal consumption in China. And as you were saying earlier, this infrastructure in place, which is hard to retire early, and the ones that own that capital don't want to shut it down or look at their return. This makes it very difficult to change emissions growth and move on to a lower emission pathway. And so this is, I guess, the ultimate challenge with climate policy, how to transition from a system where we've already got our infrastructure in place.
And I presume that this information which came out into the public domain shortly before the Washington climate change talks, and I think was probably digested by the delegates in Washington in the last few weeks, I can imagine that this contributed to the fact that the atmosphere in the talks was quite serious, I think. That some of the delegates were saying, actually, well, you just talk and talk and talk, you've actually done anything, you know. Did you feel that during the Washington talks?
Well, talks from an observer's perspective, but the talks are certainly very instrumental. There's a lot of conflict that needs to be sorted out and a lot of language issues to be sorted out. And
early attempts
was a little bit of a cat and mouse between developing countries, which has been going on for many years. And so it's frustrating for those that want to see climate policy advance and emissions reduced.
Yeah.
But it's perhaps an inevitable process that we have to go through.
Yuri, would you like to just say something
finally
before we close
it out then? Well, I could say on a optimistic or a positive note that indeed Kyoto was actually put in place to first target emissions in developed countries, and then it was the idea that in 2009 a follow-up agreement would be agreed in Copenhagen. That, as everybody knows, failed.
It wasn't agreed on, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so now countries are again committed to work towards an agreement in 2015 that should be agreed upon in Paris, and that agreement should then actually comprise all global emissions in the developing countries. At this point, of course, it is clear that these are very tough and hard negotiations, but I think an important aspect of these negotiations is that countries and parties are actually talking and discussing this important issue.
Fair enough. Good point.
Okay, well, with that optimistic note, thank you very much indeed, Glenn Peters, Senior Research for Cicero and Oswell, and Yuri Rajal from the Skills Federal Institute for Technology for joining us today on this EcoPlus program talking about our new Cicero report. I thank you, listeners, for being with us today. Don't forget that we have our own Facebook page, EcoPlus Russia, for the separate words, where you can download any of our programs. And you can also write comments and get in touch with me and tell me what programs you'd like to hear, what topics you'd like us to cover. So please come back next week. My name's John Harrison. Goodbye. Good afternoon, London, live in China, America. You are tuned in to the Voice of Russia. My name is Miguel Francis, and we're reporting to you live from the Russian capital. Do join us on facebook.com/thevoiceofrussia. Leave an opinion, say hello, and discuss interesting topics in the world of news. And first, follow our hourly uploads on Twitter, twitter.com/voiceofrussia. In London, you can catch us over DAB Plus in Washington, D.C., where 13.9 AM, 103.5 FM HD2. In New York, where it's 14.30 AM. And for the frequencies of Miami and Chicago, you can visit our website at thevoiceofrussia.com/US. Also, quickly on top, we'll take on air now for the live translation. Please stay tuned. We'll be back in more in just a few moments right here on Radio VR.